This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
He looks determined without being ruthless. Something heroic in his manner. There's a courage about him. Doesn't look like a killer. Comes across so calm. Acts like he has a dream. Full of passion.
You don't trust me, huh?
Well, you know why.
I do. We're not supposed to trust anyone in our profession anyway.
Peace, 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 and welcome to The Rematch, which is part of the BasketballNews.com podcast network. On The Rematch, you'll hear in-depth interviews with notable names from all walks of life. Because sometimes the media just doesn't get it right. The Rematch is that second opportunity to clarify, put things in proper context, correct fake news or misreported controversy. The media still exists as the most powerful entity on earth because they control the minds of the masses. I'm Matan Thomas, and the full truth is what we are aiming to catch. Many media stories omit details that would dilute their clickbait roar, and that's why there's a need for the rematch. Today, I sat down with pastor and activist Bishop Talbert Swan. We discussed LeBron James's legacy on and off the court after he passed Kareem for NBA's all-time leading scorer. We discussed the impact of his activism, his critics, because of his activism, Kyrie Irving backlash, the media, police brutality, tangible solutions to police brutality, the Tyree Nichols case in particular, and much more. This was a powerful discussion. Hope you enjoy. Bishop Talbert Swan, how you doing, sir?
I'm good. How you feeling?
I'm blessed. You know, I'm blessed. I appreciate you coming on the show today, the rematch on basketballnews.com and Fly TV. And I know you've been traveling. You just got back, was it yesterday, from Tyree Nichols' funeral. So I saw you speak there. You know, you gave a great speech. I just really appreciate you coming on today.
Absolutely. Glad to be here. And our continued prayers go out to the family of Tyree Nichols.
Definitely, definitely. You know, you said a lot in that speech, and there's, you know, it's interesting looking at this topic and breaking everything down. You know, I interviewed you for my book, Police Brutality and White Supremacy, The Fight Against American Traditions. And we had a great discussion on the history of white supremacy and how it was interwoven into Christianity and how, you know, they utilized Christianity to justify slavery and justify, you know, murdering and raping and pillaging and enslaving our people and twisting the Bible and twisting, you know, we talked about all that, but it's interesting seeing now, you know, we're still having the same conversations and the same topics in different forms. And right now, you know, we have a situation where a lot of people are using the narrative that, well, if the police who killed Tyree Nichols are black, how can it be white supremacy? And it's an interesting, you know, discussion. I don't know how people don't understand that, you know, white supremacy utilizes many people to implement, you know, white supremacy. I mean, this is historical. I don't even know. How do you even handle that question? You know, just before we get into everything, how do you even handle that question?
Yeah. You know, I try to educate people on it. Sometimes people are just gaslighting and they fully understand how it happens. But they're trying to create a narrative to basically dispel the reality of white supremacy in America. An example I used today on my radio program, I said, you know what, my car is built to operate a certain way. Mm-hmm. And even if you diversify the driver, even whether the driver is black, white, Latino, or Asian, that vehicle is going to operate the same way, regardless of who's behind the wheel. And so the apparatus of white supremacy is systemic and structural. It's not about the actions of particular individuals. It's about an inherent system that disenfranchises Black people and other non-white people and benefits white folks. And so even if you put Black people at the head of it or embed them within any level of the workings of it, it still operates the same way. Right. And so policing in America and so many other functions in America are inherently racist and are part of the apparatus of white supremacy. So just changing the drivers doesn't change the way the vehicle operates.
I mean, I definitely agree, you know, but it's just interesting, you know, sometimes when I hear, you know, Fox News or, you know, I know what they do and they're posing this thing. And I'm kind of like, do they really not understand this, or are they just kind of playing to a certain audience that wants to hear these certain points being made? And an example of this is how they use different people in Black media to be able to parrot some of these thoughts and things. And that's something that we've seen quite a bit, but that's another example of how a Black face can be the face of white supremacy in the media. Do you agree?
Oh, absolutely. You know, on the plantation, they used Black folks, gave them a whip and gave them certain authority and made them overseers over their fellow enslaved Black people. And they were allowed to brutalize and mistreat other Black people, all to benefit the white supremacist system. So I often say they changed the name from overseer to officer, you know, in some instances, change the apparatus and the weaponry that are used, but it all, you know, meets the same end. And every time Black people are poised to eke out some semblance of justice or freedom, there's always a Black face working with our oppressors to ensure that doesn't happen. And whether it's the slave on the plantation that tells on Nat Turner, or the enslaved person who drops dime on Denmark Vesey and stops them from their insurrection and taking over Charleston, or whether it's a Jason Whitlock or a Larry Elder or a Candace Owens in contemporary times that are working closely with white supremacy to parrot a narrative that Black folks are to blame for their own disenfranchisement. It all has worked the same way throughout history. We can always find someone who looks like us who will work with those who are against our progress and us receiving justice.
You know, you mentioned Jason Whitlock and Candace Owens, and, you know, it never fails for them to weigh in and then parrot the ideas of white supremacy when something like this happens. Like, you know it's coming. And, you know, they never disappoint. They're like right on cue, like they're on schedule. And it's just interesting because, you know, Jason Whitlock is an interesting individual. I actually sat on a panel with him that Spike Lee put on years ago, might maybe a decade ago, and back in 2011, maybe. And I sat there and, you know, we were talking about a lot of different things. You know, Jim Brown's on the panel, Stephen A. Smith, you know, all these different people. And we disagreed. Everybody, you know, disagreed, agreed. You know, it was at Morehouse College. And I listened to a lot of, I spoke with Jason Whitlock. And then the next day I saw what he wrote. And I was like, wow, I don't really think he even believes what he's writing. I think he just knows that is what a certain segment wants to hear, and they will reward him for it. And he wants to continuously going down this path. So I actually wrote an open letter to him, you know, kind of saying that was really before he blew up, you know, with them You know what I say? He blew up with them. And over the span of a decade, he's done it more and more and more. But that's even worse. If he doesn't even really believe this, it's even worse that he is putting this out there and promoting these ideas and attacking Black people. And, you know, and every time when a Black person gets killed by the police, he's right on cue of saying, well, what is this, single Black mothers? What is, you know, Black on Black crime? What is, you know, somewhere he's pointing the blame towards the victim or towards Black people or the Black community. And but he doesn't really believe it, but he knows he will get rewarded for doing this. That makes it worse, right?
Yes, he's the quintessential Stephen on the candy plantation. You know, you can check the record. Candace Owens, before ever coming out and parroting white supremacist talking points and working for Turning Point USA, she was doing videos on YouTube for Black Lives Matter. She was anti-Trump. Diamond and Silk, the same thing. But they found out quickly that it pays to be that Black person, to talk grimy about Black people, and to agree with those on the side that are against Black progress. Mm-hmm. And so many of them don't actually believe what they're saying, right, but they know what they're saying will benefit them personally. It'll get mm-hmm. them book deals. It'll get them a television program. It'll get them a spot as a talking head on Fox News or other outlets. And like you said, which makes it far worse, right, because they don't even believe in what they're doing. They're doing it for personal aggrandizement and self-promotion.
You know, interestingly enough, so, you know, LeBron James, you know, by the time this comes out, he'll probably have passed Kareem's, you know, all-time scoring list. So that would be the conversation of what he has accomplished there. And it's a great, great feat for him. I mean, you know, I mean, he's passing Kareem, you know, and then you'll talk about where the GOAT and where he falls in that category. That'll be the discussion. But really, you know, what has impressed me even more about LeBron has been his activism, the way that he's used his voice, the way that he's spoken out against racism, about police brutality, you know, and then, you know, about, you know, he's not afraid to use his platform and not afraid to have many people disagree with him. And that's something I really got to tip my hat to him for, that, because there are things that he doesn't necessarily have to do. He could have gone the route that other superstars in the past have gone, that have been very quiet and, you know, didn't rock the boat at all whatsoever. But he didn't go that route. Mm-hmm. You know, talk about the significance of him, you know, using his voice the way that he has, you know, in the span of his career.
Listen, I never got caught up in the who's better, LeBron or Michael Jordan debates or arguments. He's definitely in the top three of all time, as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. But to your point, that is what has always impressed me about LeBron James. That's what impressed me about Colin Kaepernick. You know, the willingness to go out on a limb and speak truth to power, regardless of the pushback mm-hmm. and the potential consequences of their actions. That is a rarity, you know, even throughout history. You know, you talk about Muhammad Ali's and others. They are the modern day embodiment of that type of boldness that will utilize their significant platforms to speak to the issues of the day. And at the end of the day, I think if anything propels LeBron above those in his category of greatness on the court, it's what he did off the court.
You know, it's interesting, even bringing back to what we talked about earlier with Jason Whitlock, you know, at every turn when LeBron would speak out about something, you would have somebody like Jason Whitlock, you know, trying to bash him, trying to cut him down. You know, he's ignorant. He's this, he's this. And using words to almost disparage him to make what he is saying less important. You know what I mean? Less impactful. And, you know, it's just amazing that happened, that somebody would accept that role. Of course, we know historically that has been, that somebody has accepted the role, whether it is to infiltrate a Black organization, to, like you said, to tell on Nat Turner, to, you know what I mean, to be that role whatever you want to call that role. We don't have to call names, but whatever that role is, mm-hmm. people have been willing to do it. But just seeing people like Jason Whitlock do that consistently, you know, with LeBron in particular, you know, it's just interesting to see.
Yeah, you know, each time a black celebrity, athlete, whatever their walk of life is, finds himself in a position of using their platform to speak truth in terms of our situation, there's always going to be a black person in their category that is willing to speak against what they're doing. When we look at the Kyrie Irving incident, they trotted out several former NBA stars to call him all kinds of idiots and other types of names. Mm-hmm. And then you turn around and you ask the question, how many former NFL white quarterbacks have jumped on the bandwagon to condemn Brett Favre or, you know, any white athlete who has done or said something that is far more egregious than anything Kyrie ever did. But we can always find a black person who's willing to take up that role, you know, for the benefit of affirming themselves with and getting accolades from white society.
You know, it's interesting. I interviewed Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in my book, We Matter, Athletes and Activism. And we were talking about LeBron. And, you know, at that time, Trump was constantly trying to disparage him, constantly tried to, you know what I mean, talk about him. And Kareem made a great point. He was like, well, you know, that is a compliment to the level of impact that LeBron has and how much of a threat he is to the opposition, because this is what Kareem said, I'm paraphrasing, but he said, because, you know, if he wasn't a threat, if his impact wasn't the level that it was, why would the president of the United States be worried about what he said or what his opinion on something is? You know, and that shows the power and the magnitude of the athlete voice. And I love that LeBron has utilized his voice, because then it becomes inspirational to other athletes to also use their voices. That's really what I wanted to do with my, you know, We Matter book, is to encourage all athletes to continue this tradition of activism. But, you know, the impact of their voice, I mean, that's just really an interesting topic. I think people don't really understand how much power is in someone like LeBron James.
Yeah, well, you know, the sports arena is one of those rare places where it integrates whites, blacks, Latinos, Asians, no matter what the walk of life is. Mm-hmm. Everybody's got a favorite team and a favorite player on that team. And often their favorite players is regardless of what their racial makeup is. Mm-hmm. You find the most hardline right wing Trump supporting bigot who will love a black athlete for what they do on the court.
Right.
What LeBron has done is he has said the holistic part of us is that we are more than what we do on the court. Mm-hmm. We're what we do on and off the court. We have a voice as well. And so when people like LeBron speak up, when people like Colin speak up, all of a sudden those same fans who love them mm-hmm. for what they do on the court want to relegate them to only the court. That's where the shut up and just dribble, you right. know, just going out there and catch a ball and entertain us. That's all we want you to do. Mm-hmm. But what LeBron is doing is he has expanded his reach beyond dunking a basketball or scoring 50 points. I'm going to score some points in the public sphere and speak on behalf of my people. And he's done a masterful job at that. And I think people ought to applaud him for what he's done.
And, you know, talk about the attacks that he's gotten. So you have one side that applauds him for it. Another side that viciously attacks, like not just disagrees, you know, not just has a different opinion, but viciously attacks. You know, it's It's amazing, but it's almost as if they're viciously attacking in a way that they want to discourage other athletes from doing the same.
That's exactly what they want to do. It, you know, it reminds me of, you know, Eddie Murphy was doing stand up and he was talking about, you know, how people celebrate him as a comedian and a celebrity. But then when they don't recognize who he is, he's just another nigger. Uh-huh. And he talks about, you know, walking in a truck full of white guys riding by, yelling epithets at him, nigger this, nigger that. And then when he puts his head up and they see who it is, they're like, Eddie. All of a sudden, he was a nigger a minute ago. Right, now he's Eddie.
Yeah.
And that's exactly how it is. You know, they'll cheer LeBron as long as he's on the court, right, you know, doing what they want him to do. But the moment he begins to utilize his voice and speak against some of the things that they are completely in line with, then they will turn on him in a heartbeat, as they will any other athlete. He then magically transformed from the superstar athlete to the quintessential nigger in their minds. And then he becomes everything vile that they can think of in the book. And you're right, vicious attacks, the same thing. Everybody loved Muhammad long as he just was in the ring knocking people out. Mm-hmm. But when he started saying, you know, when he refused to go in that draft,
right,
and said, a Viet Cong ain't never called me nigger.
Right.
The same folks who loved Muhammad began to hate who he was and what he stood for. So as long as we stay on code with what we're supposed to be, as long as we stay in our place, you know, mm-hmm, as to where they have designed for us to be, we're fine. But the moment we get off code and we get outside of that box, then we become everything but a child of God.
And it's just so amazing. I mean, people are kind of glossing over it now and they don't want to talk about it now anymore. But the way that I saw everybody kind of turn on Kyrie after he shared the link, Hebrews to Negroes, and the way that they used, to all of your points earlier, as far as using black people in particular in the media to bash him, former black players to bash him, you know, and it was like everybody got the same memo to bash him, yeah, collectively at the same time. And I'm talking about black media. I'm not even talking about, you know, other media and other people in Fox News and say, I'm not even talking about them. I'm talking about specifically black media. Everybody was on the same page as bash Kyrie. He's anti-Semitic, you know, denounce him. He's dumb for doing that. How dare he do that tweet? And I was just like, wow, all of that. I'm like, did he say any of the things that you're attributing him to believing? He just shared the tweet and said he didn't agree with all of it, but he thought it was something that he wanted to share for the information. But it just kind of goes to show you how, you know, you have to stay in a certain area or else everybody will turn on you like quick, like just like that. And, of course, there was they bring up other things that they had issues with Kyrie, like, oh, he didn't take the vaccine. Oh, he took off here. I'm like, well, what does any of that have to do with right now? Now you're making a whole list now. And it's just amazing to me to see everybody collectively do that. And I wanted you to touch on this a little bit, and not even from this perspective of people who legitimately watched the documentary and had different points that they agreed with or disagreed with. Not even talking about that, because that's with anything. I'm talking about, let's first start with the black media in particular, who just went on a straight bashing, attacking him, vilifying him, demonizing him. That really bothered me.
Oh, absolutely. It like you said, it's like they all got a memo. They all got their marching orders. They were all told exactly what to say and what to do. And it was a bash Kyrie fest among former athletes and the black media. And my question to them is, where's your level of consistency? If you're going to bash Kyrie for alleged anti-Semitism, and once again, I hate even using that term because, right, you know, for obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. But if you're going to do that, then where's your consistency in condemning other folks for their anti-blackness? Case, I'll use this as an example. Everyone went in on Kanye when he talked about Hitler, when he said some other things, when he did the Black Lives Matter T-shirt, though, it was a Jewish clothing distributor. Matter of fact, the founder of LA Apparel, who he was working with, who was prepared to distribute those White Lives Matter T-shirts. Mm. As soon as Kanye offended the Jewish community, that person decided they're going to cut the deal. They're not going to distribute the T-shirts. And so my question was, why was he willing to distribute those anti-Black T-shirts? Right. But all of a sudden, now he can't do it. No one condemned him for that level of hypocrisy.
Right.
Kyrie comes out, shares a link, says, hey, you ought to take a look at this. You know, there's some things in here you may agree with. There's some things you don't agree with. And it's like Black folk got marching orders.
Yeah.
What they needed to do for this young man. Yet when I've never heard the same folks condemn Nick Fuentes. Mm. Never heard them condemn Donald Trump for his anti-Semitism. I've never heard them condemn many right-wing evangelicals who use Israel for their own particular reasons, but are completely anti-Semitic. Mm-hmm. Never heard them do that. And then, conversely, when you talk about a Tyree Nichols, and when you talk about these other incidents of police brutality and anti-Blackness, where are those voices? Where's the Charles Barkley's and the Shaquille O'Neal's on this case with Tyree Nichols, or the cases that preceded that case? Now, right. If you can't speak out against the brutalization of Black bodies, mm-hmm. if you can't speak out on anti-Blackness, what's the sports team owner who came out utilizing the N-word and such, and they fined him but didn't force him to sell his team like they did Donald Sterling back in the day. My question is, where were your voices in that incident?
Right.
All of a sudden, you're so bold when it comes to condemning your brother, but we can't find you. You're quiet as a rat peeing on cotton when it comes to speaking out against anti-Blackness that happens around you every single day.
I mean, and then you'll have someone like Jerry Jones, and the picture came out about Jerry Jones, and then you'll have certain people in the Black media rushing to defend him. Like, not even just, you know, him rushing to his defense. I was like, wow. And it's the same people who rush to condemn Kyrie, to criticize Kaepernick, to criticize, you know what I mean? It's those the same exact people.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, they with the quickness, not only did they rush to defend Jerry Jones, the owner of the UFC, that Dana White, who smacked his wife, they ran to defend him as well. Oh, that's a one-time incident. We don't know. He's apologized, so on and so. And I could not see the same people who were giving him the benefit of the doubt, right. Saying that was probably the first time, giving that level of grace to a Black man had he done the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. And so you got to question the veracity of these folks that are so quick to defend white folks for things that they would throw a Black person under the bus for doing. Then my other question is, like, you know, I got to ask Stephen A. Smith, you know, because everybody's a good friend, a dear friend. How come you got so many racist good friends? I'm confused about that.
Yeah, no, I mean, he does seem to vouch for a lot of people who tend to be on the side, like, of racism.
Every time a white person in the sports world does something crazy and anti-Black, you know, he's always out there talking about what a wonderful person that they are. They might be wonderful to you,
right?
But they ain't wonderful to the rest of us.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. But even, you know, and the thing is, it's not just one key person. It's not, you know, it's a whole collective group. And that's the part where, you know, when you were making a connection earlier as far as how black people were utilized to support white supremacy. And even what we started off with Tyre Nichols, of those black police officers and how, you know, they're a part of the system of white supremacy. So it's the notion that, you know, it can't be a part of, you know, the entire system of white supremacy if there are black faces involved. That's just not true.
Yeah, black faces in white spaces does nothing to dismantle white supremacy. You've got to dismantle systems and structures. You've got to go after laws, policies, procedures, practices to begin to dismantle white supremacy. The reality is this: those same five black officers, even if there were no cameras, would have never beat a white man the way that they did Tyre Nichols. And the reason they wouldn't have done it is because they would have known that they would never get away with it. They thought, because of the history of white supremacy in policing, because of what they have seen through the years, that they could brutally beat this man, go back to the police station, make up a story in their police report, and that they would walk away scot-free and get away with what they did. That's the reason they did it. And only in a white supremacist system would they do that.
So, and, you know, it's interesting in looking at this, and I'm going to, you know, use a different example, another example from my book, Police Brutality and White Supremacy, The Fight Against American Traditions. I spoke to a young man named Corey McCoy. Now, Corey McCoy's brother was Willie McCoy, and Willie McCoy was killed at the Taco Bell in Vallejo, California, if you remember. So he fell asleep. He was asleep in a parking lot. Somebody called from the inside of the Taco Bell for the police just to do a wellness check, just to check and make sure he's okay. He's asleep. The car is still running. Just check on him. And the police came, of course, with guns blazing, shot into the car. They said they thought they saw something that could have been a gun. There was no gun found, but they murdered him. Mm-hmm. And the report that they initially gave before the video came out, it absolved them of any wrongdoing. They didn't describe it as far as what really happened. But then the video came out later, and then people saw what it really happened. So that's one situation. I spoke to Steven Jackson, former NBA player, in my book, and we talked about George Floyd. Mm-hmm. And the same thing happened there, where their initial police report, after they murdered George Floyd, didn't mention anything about, you know, restricting his breathing, kneeing on his neck, none of that stuff. The way that they described it, you know what I mean, was he just happened to die. And if it wasn't for 16, 17-year-old Darnella Frazier, we would have never seen that video. And so we saw the police report initially come out, and then the video came out later, and it was completely opposite of what the video said. Yeah. Now we move to Tyre Nichols. The same thing happened again with these cops. Their initial report was completely different than when this video came out and what was described in the video. So this is a pattern of, like, it doesn't make sense to have, like, they're not going to tell on themselves. They're not going to say that. It's like almost, you know, you're expecting them to report on themselves to get themselves in trouble. They're going to lie and say, but that's a bad setup. Mm-hmm. So the whole setup. So when people don't understand how, you know, this entire system is built for police not to have accountability for not them, not you're asking them to hold themselves accountable. Somebody else has to hold them accountable, not themselves.
Yeah, there's no checks and balances. There are no checks and balances. When I write a report about my own behavior, what do you think that report is going to actually say?
Right.
It's not going to say, well, you know, I made a mistake. I did the wrong thing. It's always going to give the best case scenario that will give me the best possible outcome. Another example. Laquan McDonald, you know, in Chicago, the mayor of the city, who now works for the Biden administration, helped cover that up by burying the video, and a court had to order them to release that video, which showed the police shooting him in the back 16 times. This happens over and over again, where a police report is the exact and polar opposite of the facts of what actually happened, which is the reason why whenever the media writes about an incident based on what the police told them, and the white folks say, well, see there, Bishop, he did have a gun. I'm like, oh, yeah, the police report said that. Oh, the police never lie, right?
So I'm
supposed to just believe, you know, what the media repeated or regurgitated directly from the police. Black people know that cops lie. I think white folks know cops lie. They're just more willing to believe the lies of the police officer because of their racism, that they're willing to believe whatever they say about black people. And that's a reality in America. That's part of the white supremacist system, which is why you can't just throw a black police chief in, throw a black captain in, throw some black sergeants in and say, see, you got all these black people, so you can't complain about racism anymore. No, it's they're just driving the same white supremacist vehicle that white folks have been driving all these years.
But they know that, though. They know that the system set up is not for real accountability. They can make adjustments to have outside and independent investigators investigate the case, not internal investigations where they're having their buddies investigate them. You know, like when, you know, back in the day we were little, and you know, you're in school and they say, okay, pass your test to the person next to you and y'all grade each other's tests. And it's your friend. You know what I'm saying? You're not going to say, oh, he got that wrong. That's just not the way that it works. But that's what they're doing with the police right now. And when they say, when mainstream America says, you know, a video comes out or something like that, okay, well, hold on. Let's wait for the facts to come out. Mm-hmm. And the facts that they are talking about coming out is the police's story. And it's just a story. It's not facts. We've seen time and time again that they do not tell the truth. They fought. But there should be a penalty for falsifying a police report. That should be a penalty.
Right now, we have a police chief in the city that I live in who was convicted of falsifying a police report.
Okay.
That conviction got overturned on a technicality. She's what we call here a Brady cop. So there's a law that says, it's named after a cop who was convicted of falsifying police reports, et cetera, that anytime you have a Brady cop, the prosecutor has to let the defense lawyers know that this cop has this on their record, which is why prosecutors are reluctant to use Brady cops, because defense lawyers can then go back into their past and say, this cop was convicted of lying on a police report before. What makes you think they're telling the truth now? Mm-hmm. My question is, why are cops who lie on police reports allowed to remain on the force in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
And then secondly, how are they allowed to move up the ranks and actually become a chief and take over a department and then talk about they're going to be the ones to root out corruption when they are part of the corrupt system that exists in the first place? Mm-hmm. So once again, this is systemic. You've got to change the system and not the people who work in the system. And as long as we're not willing to change the system, listen, you and I are going to be old and gray and still having this conversation.
And what you're talking about as far as the priors, you know, whenever you know, a black man is murdered by the police, the first thing they do is the black man who was murdered is the one who goes on trial. Then they start talking, but they never talk about the police officer's background and his priors. And every single policeman, you know, when you look at that, they've had an incident in the past where they've had at least a complaint about police brutality. Yep. I mean, you go from Daniel Pantaleo in New York, who killed Eric Garner. You go to, if you really look up and see all the stuff that he had prior to that, you know, it's like, why is he even on the force? You go to Betty Shelby in Tulsa, Oklahoma, who murdered Terrence Crutcher. She's had all of these priors and these complaints about police brutality and you know, all of these different things that she's done. And the question has to be, why are they on the force? In the first, like, yeah. What does it take for a policeman or a policewoman to be removed from the force, you know, yeah, after so many complaints? Like, what does it take?
It's rarely ever their first rodeo. When you look at a video and you see a police officer going ham on someone, whether they're beating someone, shooting them, it's rarely ever their first time engaging in that level of behavior. You even have incidents where cops are yet on the force, yet on the streets, policing folks that cities and towns and states have literally paid out millions of dollars to settle lawsuits because of their behavior, you know. And so, you know, you have the police unions and other entities that protect bad cops. There's no reason for any police officer who has cost a city millions of dollars in a lawsuit to still keep their job. In what other industry do you know of that you can literally cost your employer millions of dollars and still keep your job? Other than policing, there's no other profession where you can mess up so bad that I, as your employer, got to pay somebody $5 million and you get to stay on the job.
Right. There, it just doesn't happen. You know, I want to ask you about this because LeBron James made a tweet right after the Tyree Nichols incident became public. And his tweet said something to the effect that we are our own worst enemy. I don't know if you saw that. And so a lot of people responded very strongly to his tweet. And I wanted to get your response to it because I can give you mine, you know, after you give yours. But what was your reaction to that tweet?
So my reaction is I agreed with it, but I think it was missing context.
Okay.
In that, if you look at five officers beating a black man, you can't talk about that and divorce from it the white supremacist system that is American policing that allowed those black men to feel like we can beat this black man and get away with it. But in terms of feeling like black men beating another black man and abusing their power, knowing that we already have to fight against this wicked system that extrajudiciously brutalizes and takes away black life. I can understand saying, you know what, this is a shame that this happened with black men engaging in the same behavior that they see white folks engaging in. And to that point, we are our worst enemy. I understand him saying that, but you've got to put that in context.
Yeah,
I get the backlash.
Yeah, it's a little tough to really sum up everything in a tweet. That's more of a, you have to have a conversation about that. That's, you have to break it down because
you need to write an op-ed on that.
Right. Because I mean, you know, for me, you know, I do expect more from black policemen. I do expect more for, like, it's like when you're driving and you're pulled over and you see the lights and everything like that. Then you see the black policeman come out. You're like, okay, whew, I can relax a little bit. You know what I mean? Not completely, but I can relax a little bit. But then you see the black police one is the one who pulls you out the car and throws you on the hood. Then you're like surprised because you don't expect for him to do that.
Yeah.
You know, and
like over backwards to prove I'm not going to be soft on black people.
Oh, 100%, 100%. But that was also the reason why, you know, I was so shocked to see my reaction was so strong of seeing the black people in the media be the ones to go and bash Kyrie the way that they did. Because I expect that from certain people, you know what I mean? In the media, mainstream, Fox News, you know, even them, CNN, whatever. I don't expect that from black media, you know what I mean? And they were like taking their turns. I was on this program with Torre, and I've read Torre and stuff for the longest, but the way that he started bashing Kyrie, I was like, whoa, Like, are you serious, man? Like, and but it's not just Torre, just one person. It's all, you know, I could go down the list and name, because it was really, like we said, everybody was like, on, like they got the same memo and they had to say the same things.
And then so you have to ask those folks, where are y'all when they're unnecessarily going after other black folks? You know, yeah. when you see an incident where they go after Toni Morrison because of her stance, when they go after an Angela Davis because she speaks on behalf of Palestinian people, mm-hmm. where are these same black media personalities? When a CNN fires a Mark Lamont Hill for saying he wants to see a free Palestine from the river to the sea, right. Of course, not in any way meaning the same thing that Hamas means.
Right. Right.
But CNN gets rid of him. Then they turn mm-hmm. around and they bring Bill Maher on. That's another story.
Right. right.
But where are you in terms of speaking on behalf of us mm-hmm. when that same community comes out to take away people's resources and ruin people's careers? Mm-hmm. You know, it's like they're afraid. It's like they have some kind of marching orders that, you know, thou shalt condemn black people who mm-hmm. offend us, mm-hmm. but then you will say nothing when we do something that's against black people.
Right.
It's amazing that we have people out there that have platforms, that have influence, that are willing to march to their drum, but not do the same thing in condemnation mm-hmm. of the things that they do.
And the level of expectation is different. For me, the level of expectation is different from black media, just like the level of expectation is different from black police officers or black teachers. You know what I mean? Or black, whatever positions that people in. Yes, of course, the levels should be different. But it's interesting. You know, in my book, again, I interviewed Captain Sonia Pruitt. She's a retired policeman from Montgomery County. She was a captain. And in Police Brutality and White Supremacy, the Fight Against American Traditions, she said that many policemen, and I'm paraphrasing, but she said many policemen have to choose whether they're going to be black or they're going to be blue. Mm. And many, you know, that's the choice and the dilemma that many black police officers face. And you'll see a lot of times, you know, you'll say, brother, how can you? And they're like, I'm not your brother. Like, they'll say that. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know if you ever heard a black police officer say that.
Oh,
they
have.
Make that distinction. I am not your brother. Mm-hmm. And that is just, you know, you have that expectation that there is going to be a certain level of connection because, yes, you are a black man and I'm a black man.
Yeah.
And so that's what I heard from LeBron's tweet. But he has to, you know, like you said, that got to be an op-ed. That got to be a whole conversation and breakdown. You can't sum that up in a tweet.
Yeah. You know, what I said was in response to the same incident, I said, black men have to stop putting on blue uniforms and acting like they're white. You know, she said they got to decide whether they're black or blue. Mm-hmm. I say that they put on the blue and then somehow think that they can do the same thing that white folks can do. Right. And they're going to find out that system that protects white folks for doing certain thing, it doesn't afford you the same level of protection.
Now, one of the things that Attorney Ben Crump said is that he wanted this to be a watershed moment. That's the word that he used, the phrase that he used, where now we see how swiftly, I mean, anybody with eyes had to have noticed how swiftly these five black officers were brought to justice. Like, it was quick. And so now moving forward, is that going to be something that's going to be a practice that extends to white officers? I don't have much hope in that, but I understand that he was saying that he hopes this is a watershed moment and now they can use the swiftness of how these five officers were brought to justice to now, you know, I make the case that these should happen in other situations where there are white officers. I'm not holding out too much hope that that's going to translate when there are white policemen. But what do you think? Let me ask what you think.
that's not going to happen. That's not even going to happen in Memphis, where this quickly happened. This unprecedented timeline of being terminated within 10 days, being charged with murder within 20 days. You are not going to see white men engage in the same behavior and face that level of justice that quickly. And it still remains to be seen whether or not they're convicted. And if they are convicted, what level of sentencing they will receive. So this marathon is not yet over, but you're not even going to see it get to this point in that level of time. Now, I'm hoping I'm wrong. I hope that the system will shock me and say, you know what? We learned a lesson, you know, from the Tyre Nichols case, and we're going to use that as the model, and we're going to move swiftly so that we can mitigate these cases and hold people accountable in an expeditious manner. But like you, I'm not holding out to see that happen. And then at the end of the day, like I said, it still remains to be seen what level of justice they're going to see. We also have to remember, even in a predominantly black city like Memphis, you're still subject to have all white juries. Now, they may be more willing to convict black officers than they would white officers. So I do think they'll be convicted. I do think they'll get sentences. But we'll then be talking about the disparity between the level of sentence they got in comparison to white officers. You look at a Jason Van Dyke in Chicago, the one who murdered Laquan McDonald, who only got sentenced to 6 years and got out after three. He's walking free right now. You know, we look at an Amber Geiger who killed Bolton John. She got 10 years. You know, she's going to be walking very soon, you know, because there's no way she's going to do all 10 of those years. So when you think about the fact that a black person will get sentenced to a longer sentence for a drug possession or for harming an animal than a white cop will get for actually murdering a black person.
Wow. Well, I'm not going to keep you too long. You know, I could talk to you all day, but let me just say, sum it up with this. You know, you are a bishop, a man of the cloth, and I've always, you know, told you this repeatedly, how much respect I have for you and your willingness to talk about racism, about white supremacy, about injustice, about police brutality, in a way that you don't see a lot of men of the cloth speaking to, you know, and especially and definitely not on a consistent basis. And then your willingness to call out white evangelicals who are posing as Christians. I'll say it like that. And you know, echoing some of the sentiments of their forefathers where they're intertwining and twisting scripture to be able to support racism and white supremacy. But you call it out. Not a lot of men of the cloth, you know, black or white, have done that. You know, what makes you so different? What makes you be able to do that? And then that two-part question, and then talk about the backlash that you receive for doing that.
Yeah. You know, I do it because I cannot divorce history or our modern circumstances from my theological perspective. You know, Jesus, in his first message, he says, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me, for he have anointed me to preach good tidings to the poor, to deliver those that are captive. And in that context, he was talking about those that were wrongfully imprisoned, because at that time, Israel was occupied by Rome, by a white supremacist system. So he's talking about those who are unfairly and unjustly imprisoned, to heal the brokenhearted and to set at liberty those that are oppressed. That's what he said his mission was. And how can I be an oracle of God? How can I be one who teaches the tenets and the teachings of Christ and ignore why he said he came and who he said that he came for? So I don't even understand clergy, black or white, who divorce the message of social justice from their message. you know, when over 2,000 times the Bible talks about just what does the Lord require of thee, but to do justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with our God. People think this was a MLK quote, but it was MLK actually quoting the book of Amos when he said, let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. So I can't divorce the message of justice from scripture. Mm-hmm. And therefore I have to be one who stands up for it and who speaks out on behalf of those persons who are oppressed. I'll leave it with this. James Cone, the great theologian, said any authentic theology must affirm that God is on the side of the oppressed. Mm-hmm. Those are the people that we have to speak for. And of course, just like Jesus got backlash. See, people have to realize Jesus was lynched because he fought against a white supremacist system of oppression. Mm-hmm. I know people, we like to use the term, he died for our sins. Yes, that too. But he was lynched by a white supremacist system for being a radical agent of change. Mm-hmm. And anybody who speaks truth to power is going to face backlash. And so on a consistent basis, you know, I get death threats. I actually have an FBI agent on speed dial who consistently, I just email him the latest death threat I got. They literally call my church to give me death threats.
Wow. Wow.
I mean, all kinds of vitriol all over social media. I get emails and I get crazy. People still put a letter in an envelope and put a stamp on it and go to the post office and send it to me. You know, it's all kinds of crazy backlash that I've been getting consistently over several decades from folk, which is crazy because a lot of these folks call themselves Christians. I get emails and stuff from white preachers, evangelical preachers. Mm-hmm. One such white evangelical preacher who reached out to my national denomination, basically telling them they should remove me as a bishop. This guy had the audacity to say that he hopes that I get blood clots that stop my heart and that I drop dead. Yeah. But you're pro-life.
Right.
But you're a Christian. Yeah. And you're hoping that I drop dead. And here's the thing. White fragility is something else, because you've got to think about it when you talk about everything that Black people have been through.
Mm-hmm.
I had one person compare me to the Ku Klux Klan. I said, now, the Klan literally lynched, brutalized, burned down whole Black towns, raped Black women, kidnapped Black children, lynched Black men. I hurt your feelings on Twitter.
Right, right.
But I'm just like the Klan. Right. You're so fragile that you're comparing hurting your feelings on Twitter to everything that Black people have been through. It's insane.
Wow. And that white evangelical pastor, you know, that you referenced, didn't he say that publicly? Because it seemed like I saw that on social media. He didn't. It wasn't just a quiet, you know, thing that he said and, you know, quietly. He literally said that to everyone.
Yes, absolutely.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Well, let me just say, you know, praying for your safety and for you to continue to, you know, use your voice and your platform. I mean, it's so important. You definitely need some security because we got to keep you safe. You know what I mean? If you don't have it, you know, you have to be careful and, you know, just moving. You know, people don't like the truth.
Yeah.
People get very offended and upset at the truth. And they lash out, and you know we need your voice. So I don't know how many.
I always know. Whenever right wing media covers something I said or did, I get an immediate increase in death threats. So if all of a sudden I'm getting a bunch of death threats on my voicemail, I do a search and I'm like, oh, Fox News said something about me or the Daily Caller or one of these. And then they all flock to the phones, flock to the inboxes. It's insane.
Wow. Well, I can't say it enough. Please keep yourself protected and safe. You know, I can't say it enough. But much respect to you. You know, I kept you for an hour. That was a little bit longer than I planned to keep you. But like I said, I could talk to you all day. But much respect to you. Keep doing what you're doing. I know you are. You know, and look forward to us continuing to, you know, combine on different things. And, you know, I want to keep reading your stuff. And, you know, if you have a book that's coming out soon, let me, you know, if you want to promote it or anything like that. But like I said, much respect to you.
All right. Appreciate you, my brother.
All right. Thanks a lot.
All right. Bless. Take care.
Thank you for listening to The Rematch. You can find more episodes on basketballnews.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening. Be sure to subscribe and leave a review. You can also find my articles on basketballnews.com, along with exclusive content from Kenyon Martin, James Posey, and more. Follow me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at AtonThomas36. Let me know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see as a guest. I would love your feedback.